My name is Dorothy, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. I love you, too. My home group is a step-by-step group in Plainfield, New Jersey. I bring you greetings, and there are three members of the step-by-step group present tonight. And I want to thank them for their support. And I got sober at the One Parkway group in Philadelphia. You know, I want to say a couple of things before, you know, Jim was saying he's not nervous. I'm not ashamed to admit that I am. My biggest fear is that I'm going to forget my story. But there's a couple of things I want to say before I get started. I want to first, I think that the entire PENSAPA committee and everyone that had a part to play in putting on this event deserves a really special round of applause. It's an honor and a privilege to have been asked to be here this weekend and to be part of this. And when they told me when I walked in these doors that it was going to be beyond my wildest dreams, I had ceased having dreams. And, you know, I didn't believe you. I believe that there may be miracles in your life, but I never thought there were going to be any miracles in mine. And, you know, being here this weekend and being surrounded, you know, some of you have never met me before. And then there are people in this room who knew me from the very first day I came and turned myself in to Alcoholics Anonymous. So some of you will only hear about what I was like. And some of you know firsthand what I was really like. And tell you the truth, sometimes I forget. But I had a wise sponsor that I got when I was 4 months sober, and she suggested that I document my recovery by getting a journal. And I've kept a journal of my sobriety since I was 4 months sober, and I have about 7 volumes now of that journal. And I usually read like the preceding year, the year before I come up on my anniversary. And one of the things that it does for me is it helps me to remember that sobriety is progressive too, just like alcoholism. And this is the first young people's conference that I've had an opportunity to experience offhand. I can tell you about my first experience, my first exposure to young people and Alcoholics Anonymous. I was about 9 months sober. And I reluctantly signed up to go on the trip, the bus ride, to Akron, Ohio. It wasn't something that I was interested in doing, but I was one of these alcoholics. Somebody told me there's two varieties. There's those that come to AA and sort of surrender peaceably and know that, well, I'm home and I belong here. And then there's the other type that I fall into, and that's the kicking and screaming variety. I did not want to be here. I did not want to be part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think I fit in, and I had a secret hope. I went to meetings early, and I stayed late because I wanted to give you enough time to tap me on the shoulder sort of quietly after the meeting and say, Dorothy, you know, you do have a lot of problems, but you're not really an alcoholic. Because I had hoped that you were going to tell me that because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. There were a lot of things that I didn't want to do, and it says somewhere in our step book that many of us have to learn to do things that go against our natural instincts and to go against our natural desires, and that's the way it was for me. And so I had difficulty giving up people, places, and things. I thought that I was going to get well enough in Alcoholics Anonymous that I was going to be able to feel comfortable in that world that I didn't feel comfortable in and where alcohol stopped working for me. And that's what I thought was going to happen to me. And so I had a sponsor who was very wise, and she didn't say, Dorothy, stop going around to that disco. She said, well, you know, and I was telling her, but I got to go on vacation. I got to go to Club Med. I do this every year. And she said, you know, there's the grapevine, and in the back they have these pages, and they have AA events. And you can start signing up for some of them. You know, just put a little balance in your life. And she said, anyway, you know, the roundup is coming up in the Philadelphia Intergroup, and now it's called Southeastern Pennsylvania. Did I get that right? It's having a roundup. That's something that you could consider. And she said, then there's this trip to Akron, Ohio. And I said, are you going? And she said, yeah, I'm going. I said, okay. So I signed up for that. And it was at that trip, that first trip to Akron, Ohio, and I was 9 months sober. And I felt so out of place. It was like maybe 600 or 700 sober alcoholics. And I walked in that arena that night, and I said, gee whiz, I don't feel like I belong here. Scared me to death. And I went into the ladies' room, and there was a woman in that room, and I don't know how she knew, but she said, is this your first time? And I said, yes. And she said, well, you keep coming back because it's going to get better. And she didn't tell me a lie. And that night I went off by myself because the people I came with were having such a good time, and I couldn't stand it. So I stumbled into this alcathon, and it turned out that it was a young people's alcathon. And I couldn't believe the energy that was in this room. And every 15 minutes or so, they took hug breaks. And people were coming up to the podium, and they were saying, some of them, they looked like they were 20 years old, and they were talking about they had 5 years sobriety, and they were talking about what they were able to do as a result of the precious gift of sobriety. And there was this joy, and there was this energy, and there was this confidence and self-esteem, and it scared me to death. I didn't think I'd ever have that. I was 33 years old when I stumbled into, I surrendered to this program, really. And I felt so old. I was convinced that if there really was reincarnation, then I was an old soul. And lo and behold, I've gotten younger and younger in sobriety. I like the definition that you have of young. Anyone who still has room to grow. I don't want to ever stop growing in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I can tell you one thing. I don't really care much for the growing pains. That I could live without. You know, I've learned in this program that God certainly does work in mysterious ways. And I believe today that my higher has a plan for me that is better than anything that I could come up with myself. I also have come to believe that I don't have to figure it out. It's not like a quiz show. I don't have to guess what's behind door number one in order to get it. And usually when I'm in the midst of this plan going on, if I try to guess what's around the corner, most often I'm wrong. And things have happened to me in this program that, you know, have just been things that I wouldn't have guessed. And one of those things happened, my second exposure to a young person, to young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, happened when I was a couple of years sober and I was getting married in sobriety. And I was such a nervous wreck that I swore on the day of, I didn't trust people to do things because, remember, I didn't believe in miracles. So I didn't believe that this wedding was ever going to come off. I thought my ex-husband was going to shoot me. I was going to have a heart attack. The man I was going to marry was going to have a heart attack. I was going to crash my car. Somebody was going to crash into me. That's the kind of anxiety that I had. And I was a little over 2 years sober at the time. And so I was afraid to drive myself to the church on the day that I was getting married. So I had a close friend who wasn't in the program, and she's my friend for a long time. She had this wonderful son. Ulysses was 18 years old at this time. And I've never had any children, but he was the kind of son that if I had had a son, he was what I would have wanted. And this young man volunteered to be my driver on my wedding day. And he came to pick me up, and he was just as gentlemanly as one could be. And on the way to the church, he was very curious about this wedding, and he was very much into it. And we were having a candlelight ceremony, and there was going to be a reception afterwards, and it was a sit-down dinner, and all of my home group members was invited, and the GSR was an usher, and the general chairperson was an usher, and the 11th step was part of the wedding vows, and we had the Our Father, and so forth and so on, just to make sure. And on the way to the church, the young man said to me, "Why aren't you having any alcohol at the reception?" And I thought that his mother would have told him that I was an alcoholic, and I realized that she hadn't broken my anonymity. And I hesitated for a minute because, to tell you the truth, at 2 years sober, I hadn't completely lost my shame of being an alcoholic. And so I hesitated because the fact that this young man had obviously admired me meant something to me, and I was afraid of how he was going to handle me telling him the truth about me. But I hesitated for a minute and I said, "Ulysses, I'm an alcoholic, and the man I'm marrying is an alcoholic. Well, most of the people that are coming to the wedding are alcoholics. And we're not going to have any alcohol." So his head just sort of tilted to the side, and that was the end of it. About, I don't know, it was less than 2 years later, his mother called me up and said, "Ulysses told me that he's an alcoholic and he's going into treatment." He was 20 years old then. And you know, thank God I learned a little bit about restraint of tongue, because I'll tell you, my initial thoughts were, he's making that up. He can't be an alcoholic. And what I thought was, instead of the disease of alcoholism that has no respect for age or race or sex or socioeconomic background, none of that, I said, his family's too nice. He's had it too good. He looks too good. I mean, this young man is the kind of guy that he can't be an alcoholic. I think he's just trying to get his mother's attention. But I didn't say anything, thank God. And Ulysses went on into treatment. And he came into the program. And I didn't know, the only memory that I had of young people in AA was that energy from that experience that I had going in that alcathon a couple of years before. And I said, "Ulysses, you know, they have this thing called Ikipa." That's all I knew about. I knew about Ikipa. And Ulysses listened, and the next thing we knew, Ulysses was in Salt Lake City. He came back, and it was like he was walking on air. And he said he ran into people that were younger than him and 5 years sober, and that there was this big discussion about who was going to live the longest to be the youngest old-timer with the most sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And let me tell you, Ulysses has dibs on that. And then, not too long after that, maybe about 2 years later, I was asked to be an anniversary speaker at a group in Philadelphia. And I went to the meeting, and who's there but Ulysses? By this time, he's about 20 years old, 21 years old, something like that. And he had never heard my story. And all he knew was that I was his mother's friend. And I put a lot of energy into controlling my drinking. And I put a lot of energy into keeping it a secret. And I put a lot of energy into keeping the respect of other people, although I had completely lost my own self-respect. And I hesitated again for a minute and said, "Should I edit my story this time?" And the thing about it is, I don't think that I've ever felt more powerless than I do when I have to get up and tell my story at an AA meeting. Because it seems like no matter what I decide to do, no matter how I intend to control it, the higher power takes over. And it comes out, my story even the story I didn't intend to tell. So although I hesitated, I told my story that night. And Ulysses came up to me after the meeting, and he was beaming the way Ulysses has beamed from the time he came into these rooms. And he said, "I identified so much with your story." And he made me realize what it's all about, because what Ulysses identified with was not the details of my story, not the fact that we had lived different lives and the details were different, but what Ulysses identified with was the pain of active alcoholism and the miracle of recovery. And so I'd like to share with you the story that Ulysses heard that night. I was born on my mother's 16th birthday in 1950 in Philadelphia. That alone was something to be ashamed of, but it took me a few years before I had learned that I should. The first several years of my childhood, I would say from the time till I was about six, was very happy. I don't think that I could have had a mother who showered me with more love, and we were really inseparable, and I don't remember a lot of that, but I remember enough of it. When I was 6 years old and I went to school, that was, I think, the first time that I had any inkling that I was different. I lived in a house, you know, our speaker Friday night was talking about 11th and Winter, and I don't know how many people are from Philadelphia and know about the police station at 11th and Winter, but he was talking about that police station. I lived on Winter Street, so I knew about that police station. And I lived in a three-story house, and there were a lot of children, so I was never alone. And I thought that, and we never went over anybody else's house, so I thought that everybody lived the way we lived until I went to school. And I found out that I was different because I found out that I lived in a neighborhood where there were Chinese kids, and at the school I went to, there were Chinese kids, there were Spanish kids, there were white kids, and there were black kids. And the Chinese kids had Chinese parents, and the white kids had white parents, and the black kids had black parents, and the Spanish kids had Spanish parents, and they had mothers and fathers. I went to school, and I didn't have a father. I sort of wasn't sure what it was even. And I'm black, my mother's white, and I knew I was different. And I remember thinking as a six-year-old that if mommy ever comes to school, I'll run away for the rest of my life. I'll just never go back. And that was a thought that I had at six. And also around that time when I went to school and I heard these kids talking about daddies and families, and plus I was watching it on TV, there were a lot of family shows, not Cosby like it is today, but there was Father Knows Best, there was Donna Reed, and I watched these TV shows, and I wanted to have the kind of family like I saw on television. And all I knew, there was a mommy, there was a daddy, there were kids, and people were happy, and everything always worked out. And so when I was seven, my mother told me she had met this man in the church, and that he was going to be my daddy. And we were going to go live with him. And I was really, really looking forward to it. And I thought at last I was going to have that thing that I wanted. The dream lasted for about 6 months. And one day when I was 7 years old, my stepfather called me in his bedroom. And I had been raised in a church. That was my mother's primary outlet, you know, social activity. And so I knew that certain things were very, very serious matters. And my stepfather pulled down the Bible from the dresser, and he said, I want you to put your hand on this Bible and swear that what's going to happen, you'll never tell. And swearing on the Bible meant something to me. And then what happened was my stepfather raped me and continued to sexually abuse me for the next 6 years. And I kept it a secret. And during those years, I taught myself how not to feel. I taught myself how to hide what I was feeling. And I remember I used to walk around with this terrible fear that people were going to be able to read across my forehead what I was thinking. And that was the fear that I had for many, many years until I began to recover in this program. When I was 13 years old, I told my mother about the incest. And my mother didn't do anything about it. Thank God, for the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know today that my mother didn't do anything, not because she wanted to, didn't want to, but because she couldn't, because she was a victim too. But I didn't know it then. And I remember being very, very, very angry. Angry at my mother, angry at the world, feeling alone, feeling betrayed, and feeling even more different. By this time, I had discovered also who my father was, and I had discovered that my birth had been the result of incest, and that my father was my mother's stepfather, and that he was married to my grandmother, and that he had 22 children, and I was just one of them. And so at 13 years old, I had my, it really wasn't my first suicide attempt, it was my second. And these suicide attempts weren't really, I don't think, because I wanted to die. I just wanted to leave. And so I went to the drugstore and I got a bottle of over-the-counter sleeping pills. And I always watched a lot of TV and I read a lot of books and I knew people killed themselves with sleeping pills. And the only place I knew you could get sleeping pills when I was 13 years old was in the drugstore. So I went and I bought a bottle. I took the whole bottle and I rode a trolley car from one stop to the other, the end. And I waited to die in my usual dramatic fashion. I knew somebody was going to find me and, you know, the world was going to say what a tragedy it was that this poor 13-year-old killed herself. Nothing happened. I didn't even get a stomach ache. And I figured that God was telling me something. I figured that the message was that I was in this world alone and that I had to take care of myself. And that was the way it was. And then I went into my angry period and my big, rough, tough, bad period. I learned how to talk rough and I learned how to talk tough. I learned how to threaten my stepfather and tell him that if he laid one hand on me, he was going to be 6 feet under the ground. I didn't know how he was going to get there, but I knew how to say it. Also, during this time, my stepfather's drinking began to be very, very obvious. I don't know when he started drinking, and I don't know how long alcohol was in the picture, but his drinking began to be obvious. And I grew up with what I know, thanks to this program, as the despair of alcoholism. One of the places, at least, that this disease could take a family. And we lived in the shabbiest house on the block, not because there wasn't money, but because there wasn't hope. And it was the dirtiest house on the block, and ours was a house that wasn't painted, and ours was a house that didn't have rose bushes in the yard. Ours was a house where the roaches went in every which direction if you turned on the light. And ours was a house that the stuffing came out of the sofa. And I was so ashamed. And I remember learning how to manipulate my environment so that I could get out of there as much as I could. And I never knew whether my stepfather was going to come home and from his drinking where he was going to be in this jovial mood and give us all money and buy fish, or whether he was going to come home and threaten to blow my brains out. And during this time, I learned to say, pull the trigger, who cares? And I taught myself how not to even feel fear during that period. And to tell you the truth, if I had any idea of what alcohol could do for me and to me, I would have started drinking a lot younger. But I didn't discover the magic and what was for me the magic of alcohol until I was 16 years old. But I can tell you it was up until I began to experience gratitude for sobriety. I don't think there was anything in life that I ever felt more grateful for than that first experience that I had with alcohol. It happened when I was 16 years old, and by this time, I was beginning to get very anxious about my future. I was beginning to think, what are people going to think if they find out about me? What am I going to tell a guy if he asks if I'm a virgin? Was I or wasn't I? What are people going to find out if they know about what kind of house I live in? How am I ever going to date? What are people? Then I also thought I was unattractive, and I thought that I wasn't very smart, and I thought that I was. I always had this inferiority complex. And I also had this self-centeredness because I thought everybody else was talking about me and wondering about these things and dying to ask me all these questions that I was afraid of answering. And then I was in Atlantic City and I was with a couple of my girlfriends and they came from that family that I saw on TV. So they weren't bad girls. I was with them and we were in a bar and the cocktail waitress came over to me and she said, "You order or get out." And I thought that I had won. I figured that I must have been the most sophisticated looking one in the bunch that she would ask me. I didn't know anything about drinking except I knew my stepfather drank old bourbon. I didn't know he was an alcoholic. I thought he was a bum. And I figured that that wasn't any good stuff, so I wasn't going to drink any of that. But I read books and I watched TV, so I ordered every drink that I ever heard of that I thought was sophisticated. So that night I ordered scotch and milk, I ordered rum and coke, I ordered Tom Collins, I ordered whiskey sours. I didn't order beer because I didn't think that was sophisticated. And I did not get sick. I did not pass out. I didn't even black out. I'm sure I was drunk. I didn't call it that because I thought I was in control. But it was wonderful. And it was so exciting because all of a sudden I knew that I didn't have anything to worry about anymore. All of a sudden, I didn't feel fat anymore. I didn't feel unattractive anymore. I knew I didn't have to worry about how I was going to handle those questions anymore. And then my friends were so impressed with me. They talked about how daring I was and how funny I was and how I had said so-and-so to such-and-such and all of that. And I knew that it was going to be okay after all. And it was like I breathed a sigh of relief. I knew what it felt like to be normal for the first time in my life, or so I thought. And God knows how I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. It certainly was not my intention. The thing about it is, I didn't start drinking every day right away. I didn't need to. I can tell you I started loving alcohol from the very beginning. And I drank it when it was available and when it was an opportunity. And in the beginning, the list of things that I needed alcohol to do was very short. Very short. I think the primary thing that I remember saying I needed a drink to do in the beginning was to dance. I figured I couldn't dance, and alcohol gave me the ability to dance. In fact, it used to tell me when I could dance because there used to be a click that would go off in my head. And I would go to the party and I'd wait for the click to go off. And if somebody asked me to dance before the click go off, I'd say no, you know, come back a little later. I didn't tell him about the click, but I knew about it. And I didn't start out getting drunk. I didn't want to be drunk. I wanted to be in control. I wanted to sort of just have a buzz on. I wanted to be able, you know, I didn't want to make a fool out of myself. I wanted to be able to dance. I wanted to be cool. The click would go off. It usually took maybe three drinks. And I would tell whoever was mixing them, don't make them too strong. And that's how it started out. And then it got so that I could argue better when my boyfriend and I had a fight if I had a drink. And then it got so that making up seemed a little better if I had a drink. And then it got so that sex was a little better if I had a little drink. And my life, then it got so that my conversation was a little better if I had a little drink. And, you know, I began to like me and me more and more when I had a little drink. My life went in a lot of different directions. I ended up getting in a lot of trouble in school. I ended up dropping out of school. And then I ended up going back to school. And I ended up going to college. And I ended up getting a scholarship to college. And I was always in fear that I was going to get found out because I knew I wasn't smart. And I don't know how I got to college in the first place. And I knew it was just a matter of time before the people found out. But I had a secret. I knew what would take care of that. A little drink. And I used to go into the, I would stop at the state store in the morning usually, or I'd get it the night before, and you'd get these nice big plastic glasses, cups, that you could put a container on and put a straw in. I'd get a fifth of wine and I'd pour it in there. And a fifth, I mean, it would take up almost the whole thing. And I'd go to class and I'd sit all day long. I was a good student. Answered a lot of questions. All my teachers knew me. And they said I was a good student. And I don't think any one of them would have ever guessed what was in that cup. And then tests would come, or papers I'd have to write. And I'd get scared, and I'd think, I can't do this. But with a little drink, I could. And I'd have my little drink, and I'd write my papers and say, gee, I'm brilliant when I drink. And it didn't seem like alcohol cost me that much. There were only some telltale signs. Like I got a car, and I would drive it under any and all conditions. And my school was, I started commuting, and my school was maybe 50 miles, like an hour drive. I drove at 90 miles an hour back then, sometimes. And I'd get home, I'd get back to Philadelphia in about 50 minutes. And I was drinking all day, so I would wet myself because I couldn't control my bladder from the time I left school to the time I got home. That was one of those telltale signs. My solution was to clean my car out, to stop by my boyfriend's house to wash my clothes and change them. I remember being in my 20s after I got out of college, and this thing about wetting myself. I started wetting the bed then. And I was in graduate school. And again, I thought that I wasn't that smart, and it was just a matter till they found out and put me out of the place. And I started going out with some of my instructors, and I would go to class, and I would have a little drink before I'd go, and I would go to class. We would go to the bar afterwards, and we'd stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning, and I would think, gee whiz, it's too bad some of these people can't handle their booze. Because I would stay till the place closed, and then I would go home after the bar closed, and I would go to bed, and I would wet the bed, and I would get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, and then I would proceed to go to two jobs. And so I went to the doctor around this time, and I was maybe 22 when I started going to the doctors. And I would go to the doctors and complain about wetting the bed. And before I went to the doctors, you know, I learned about denial in this program. I didn't know what it was called then. But there was this voice in my head that said, don't tell the doctors you only wet the bed when you drink. Because the doctor will think it has something to do with your drinking, and you know it doesn't. So I went and I had bladder tests. I drank dye to have kidney tests. I had doctors tell me I had poor potty training. But they couldn't find anything physically wrong to explain why I wet the bed. By the time I got to this program, I had gone through a couple of mattresses. I even brought a new mattress when I moved because I didn't want the moving men to see how much I wet the bed. I don't wet the bed anymore. And I haven't wet the bed since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? That's definitely a gift of sobriety. I had this idea that, you know, I was so ashamed of my family, and I was so ashamed of my birth, and I was so ashamed of my life, and I kept, all I wanted in life was to be someday somewhere where I thought that other people were going to think that I was okay. And I had an idea of what I thought that would be. I figured that, well, when I got out of college and when I got a job and I got a home and I got a car, and the fact of the matter is a lot of people, including my family, thought I was more than okay. And while as I acquired all of these things, I couldn't understand why inside, instead of feeling better about myself, I was feeling more and more and more like a failure. I didn't know. I didn't find out until I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous in these rooms that alcoholism is a disease that's mental, physical, and spiritual. that explained that confusion that I was having about me back then. You see, I believe I was born an alcoholic, and the only way that I would not have gotten into the physical aspect of my disease would have been had I never had that first drink of alcohol. But I'm real glad it happened, because if I hadn't, I would have never gotten here. Nonetheless, you know, during that feeling of failure was growing and growing and growing. And I thought, well, if I get married, and I, after 8 years of trying to get a man to marry me, he finally did. And we got married, and I was totally incapable of being a wife. I thought marriage was having it my way. And when he would come home at a time when I didn't think he should come home, if I had sacrificed and cooked dinner, my idea of showing him my displeasure was throwing it against the wall. We used to separate a lot in the first 3 years of our marriage. And during that time, I would go to my drama scenes again. During that time, you know, alcohol was always constant, but whenever there was a reason for it, me to dramatize it, that went with it. And during that time, I used to go to the state store and not dress, not wash my face, not comb my hair, because I wanted the world to know how much pain I was in, and sit in the car and wait for the state store to open, because my husband had left me. And as far as I was concerned, that's what you did. I remember calling up my cousin and telling her that I was going to kill myself. She's 2 years older than me. And she came over to rescue me, and the way I was going to do it that time is I was going to drown myself in a shower. You can't drown yourself standing up in a shower. But I stood in the shower with all my clothes on, drowning myself, because there was something like I wanted to show somebody how much pain I was in, and I didn't know how you showed this pain that was on the inside, on the outside, because nobody could see it, but I could feel it, and I couldn't tell anybody, and I didn't know why I had it, and I kept thinking, well, it's because the marriage isn't working out. Then the marriage started working out, so I didn't have that excuse anymore. And inside, I still felt like a failure. And by the time I was 27 years old, I said, this feeling of failure must be his fault. And I decided it had to be him. And of course, what was there was constant was alcohol. And I made a lot of my decisions with alcohol. And I would drink and I would think. And I would drink and I would think. And I would drink and I would think. And I'd make decisions. Lots of decisions. I had no problems making decisions when I drank. And I made a decision that the problem was him. Then I made another decision the problem was men. So I started having an affair with a woman. And I ended up living with this woman. And she was taking care of me the way I always wanted to be taken care of, like I was a helpless child. And I felt guilty about hurting my husband, so I started having an affair with him. I considered myself an honest woman, so I told both of them. They felt real bad for me, and they would have conferences occasionally. Then I got a traveling job. Up to this point, I had a real respectable job working with young people. I was a school counselor. So I decided, you know, I ought to leave that job. And I got this perfect job. It was traveling. I used to be on the road 50% of the time, and I would take airplanes all over the United States and cities. And this job brought me back to Philadelphia. And I decided that I felt guilty about being in a relationship with a woman, having an affair with my husband. And so I just knew that the answer was always something else. So I began to have an affair with a married man that I met on one of these trips. The way I met him was real interesting. I was peeing my pants again. And told him my life story. And I decided he was sort of a guru. He didn't drink, and he was a vegetarian, and he was into the spirituality stuff. And I figured, you know, he's the answer. And I thought, and then one day, after I was going through one of my fits, because he didn't drink, but I certainly wasn't going to stop drinking just because he didn't. And during one of my little rampages, by this time, I was not the one who could stay till the bar closed at 2 o'clock in the morning. By this time, I was the one who, you didn't know if I was going to start a fight after 3 drinks, whether I was going to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and make phone calls, whether I was going to cuss you out or pass out in the middle of a sentence. One of my little rampages, he said, you know, something's wrong with you. Maybe you need a therapist. Well, I didn't think I needed a therapist, but I figured maybe that would keep him in my life a little longer. And I was 30 years old at this point, and people told me you got crazy when you were 30. So I decided to get a therapist. And I went to my first therapist. And I remember the first visit going to this therapist. And I said to her, you know, I don't feel excitement about anything. Nothing. And I said, you know, I get very, very low. And sometimes I get very, very high. And she said, you know, they have this drug that could straighten you out. And then she said about this disease that I might have. It wasn't alcoholism. And I knew somebody else that went to this therapist. And I knew that they had stopped drinking. So I figured I better get away from this therapist fast. So I got another therapist instead. And I got this other therapist, was perfect for me because she knew nothing about alcoholism, and many therapists do, so I'm not bad-mouthing therapists. My therapist at the time knew nothing about alcoholism, and I began to get professional alibis for my drinking. I didn't lie about my drinking in therapy, but my therapist began to explain to me why I was acting like a maniac at this point in my life. And why I was wet in the bed. And by this time I was having blackouts. And she told me that I'd have blackouts when my memory couldn't take the pain. And it would just sort of short circuit. And she told me that I was wet in the bed because I had repressed anger and fear. And by this time I was having one night stands in all of those cities I was going to, all over the country. And this was very, very far removed from the values that I not only was raised with, but that I believed in. And it was harder and harder for me to look in the mirror. And she told me that I was going through sexual exploration. And having sort of adolescence late in life. And I wanted to believe all of these things. And I became a prize patient in therapy. I went on little tours and I did little speaking commitments with my therapist. And I sort of got to be shown off with how well I was and how I was getting. I even did a TV show. And I remember the host said to me, "You look so together." And boy, did I. The outside kept looking better and better. And the inside, I was dying. From the inside out. And I knew it. And I wasn't able to stop it. And I kept thinking that if I worked hard, if I just worked hard enough, if I worked hard enough, it was going to get better. I was getting ready to be discharged from therapy. And my therapist said, "I divorced my husband in therapy, but I continued to call him like if I crashed my car drunk or something. I ended the relationship with the woman, but she still did my laundry. The married man left me, and I was getting ready to be discharged from therapy, and I had one last issue to deal with. My therapist said I needed to learn how to have healthy relationships with men, and my assignment was to go out once a week to a singles bar,
alone.